Welcome to the critique. So today we're looking at a submitted manuscript titled Toward Life Coherent Peace in the Middle East, which is this profoundly ethical white paper proposing a seven-movement framework for regional coexistence. But right off the bat, its reliance on heavily specialized academic jargon really risks alienating the exact policymakers it's trying to reach.
Yeah, that tension is it's really the central hurdle of this entire document. Because the author has built this remarkably robust conceptual architecture, but we're looking at a text that constantly whipsaws the reader, you know?
Right, it's jarring.
Exactly. In one paragraph, we're dealing with urgent, highly actionable legal realities, things like UNSC Resolutions 2735 or the ICJ Provisional Measures. And then, literally in the very next paragraph, we are just plunged into incredibly dense academic terminology.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
I mean, early in the paper, the reader is suddenly hit with John McMurtry's ontoaxiology and Humberto Maturana's structural coupling and autopoiesis. And it's a lot.
Let's actually pause right there, because I want to make sure I'm tracking the author's intent before we start, you know, dismantling the delivery. So for those who aren't deeply entrenched in biological philosophy, what exactly is ontoaxiology in this context?
Right, so breaking it down, ontology is the philosophical study of being or, well, what exists, and axiology is the study of value. So ontoaxiology is essentially the study of what is fundamentally valuable for life itself to exist and thrive.
Okay, so in plain terms, it just means prioritizing actions and systems that keep human beings alive over systems that destroy them.
Yes, exactly. And the author is using it to establish this irrefutable scientific baseline for peace.
Sure.
And similarly, Maturana's autopoiesis, that refers to how biological cells self-create and maintain themselves, while structural coupling describes how interdependent organisms survive by adapting to their shared environment.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so the author is really trying to prove that peace isn't just a moral nice-to-have, right? It's a biological imperative. If structurally coupled communities in the Middle East don't adapt to a shared viability logic, they biologically destroy their shared environment.
I mean, I definitely understand the intellectual weight of that argument. It grounds the philosophy in hard biological reality. But here is the friction.
Mm-hmm.
You don't fight a house fire by standing on the lawn reading a textbook on the thermodynamic properties of combustion.
No, you grab a hose.
And we're talking about a region experiencing acute, ongoing catastrophe right now. If you hand this paper to a diplomat or a peace builder or, you know, an on-the-ground humanitarian worker whose cognitive load is already totally maxed out by the sheer trauma of the crisis.
Oh, absolutely maxed out.
Forcing them to wade through cellular biology before they can reach the life-saving core of the argument, it just seems totally counterproductive, like asking a paramedic to read biology before giving first aid.
It is highly counterproductive. When a hardened security analyst hits section four and has to parse emotioning and languaging as biological imperatives, you really risk them just closing the paper entirely.
Yeah, they're going to check out.
The theory totally overshadows the policy. So the suggestion here is to translate these core theoretical concepts into accessible policy-adjacent language within the main text and just reserve those heavy academic frameworks for the footnotes. Or the appendices.
Make the theory serve the policy.
Exactly.
But wait, doesn't stripping the academic scaffolding out of the main text sort of hollow out the author's credibility? Because they clearly want to prove this framework is scientifically grounded, not just, you know, diplomatic fluff.
Right, but we aren't deleting the rigor. We're simply repositioning it for the end user. Think about how we can approach this translation. Instead of using a term like Maturana structural coupling in the main body, the text could just refer to interdependent communities sharing a field of consequence.
Oh, that's much better.
Right. That phrasing captures the exact same biological truth, that what happens to one group unavoidably impacts the other, but it uses the vocabulary of international relations and diplomacy.
That instantly lowers the barrier to entry. It actually feels actionable rather than abstract.
Yeah, and another route the author could take is a bigger structural shift. Those heavy theoretical lenses dominating Section 4, they could be moved entirely to Appendix B, sitting right alongside the glossary.
Which frees up the front of the paper.
Exactly. By moving the deep biology to the back, it allows the author's brilliant, highly accessible contrast between victory logic and viability logic, which is currently sitting in Figure 1, to lead the argument right out of the gate.
I love Figure 1. It's so clear.
It is. So you hook the diplomat with the practical paradigm shift first. Then, if they really want to understand the cellular biology underpinning that shift, they can just turn to the appendix.
Right. There's also the question of tone, though. When I read the phrase biology of love in an academic setting, I recognize it as a precise Maturanan term. But if you drop biology of love onto the desk of a security analyst looking for Middle East policy solutions...
Yeah, they're going to roll their eyes.
It triggers an immediate cynical reflex, I suspect.
It definitely risks sounding overly sentimental to the exact audience that needs to take it seriously. So one way to bypass that cynicism is to reframe the concept purely in terms of relational trust building.
Relational trust building. Okay.
Yeah, because relational trust building is a known commodity in diplomatic circles. It demands the exact same empathetic engagement and structural adaptation the author is advocating for, but it speaks the native language of the policy world.
You maintain the intellectual rigor while drastically increasing the accessibility.
Precisely.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So if we assume the language is successfully streamlined to be actionable for a diplomat, we immediately run into the next major hurdle.
The structure.
The structure, yeah. Handing a practitioner a clear tool is vital, but presenting both a 7-movement life coherent peace protocol and a separate 7-step life coherence arbitration test creates structural redundancy, and that really dilutes the actionable impact of the paper.
Oh, the mental tax this places on the reader is significant. The manuscript currently gives us 2 distinct, parallel frameworks separated by, like, several pages.
Right.
In Section 7, we have the macro-level peace protocol, charting a path from protecting the life ground all the way to disarming the political economy of war. But then the reader reaches Section 9, and they're handed the arbitration test, which is another 7-step sequence designed to resolve tragic collisions.
And as I understand it from the notes, these 2 frameworks are heavily overlapping anyway.
Highly overlapping. Both are concerned with protecting the life ground. Both emphasize distinguishing genuine life needs from strategies of domination. I mean, it feels like we're handing a mediator 2 different GPS systems, mounting them on the exact same dashboard, and having them shout directions at the same time.
Yes. Even if they're taking you to the same destination, the overlapping noise just causes total confusion.
That's a great analogy. So the actionable suggestion here is to subsume the arbitration test directly into the peace protocol. Rather than treating them as separate architectures living in different sections of the text, the arbitration test needs to be framed explicitly as the micro-application.
Like the engine inside the car.
Exactly. The specific operational engine that drives the macro protocol forward.
But are we sure the author didn't intend them for 2 completely different scenarios? I mean, a protocol feels like a multi-year overarching strategy, whereas an arbitration test sounds like something you do in a room over a weekend to resolve a specific border dispute.
Even if that's the intent, the text currently fails to signal that distinction clearly. And more importantly, they rely on the exact same philosophical mechanics.
That's true.
You can't execute the multi-year protocol without navigating those weekend border disputes. One is literally the vehicle used to navigate the other. Let's look at how this integration could actually look on the page.
Okay, give me an example.
So the author has a life coherence arbitration worksheet currently buried all the way back in Appendix C. They could integrate that worksheet explicitly into Movement 3 of the peace protocol.
Remind me, Movement 3 is?
Movement 3 is all about distinguishing life needs from domination strategies. And the arbitration worksheet is literally the step-by-step diagnostic tool used to make that exact distinction.
Oh, wow. So they belong together.
Exactly. By merging them, the author hands the reader the theory and the operational tool in the exact same breath.
That turns a philosophical mandate into an immediate desktop exercise for a mediator. You don't just tell them to distinguish needs from domination. You literally hand them the worksheet that forces them to do it.
And it can be reinforced visually, too. In Figure 3, the author could visually link the 7 questions of the arbitration test directly to the 7 movements of the protocol.
How would that work visually?
Well, for instance, question 4 of the arbitration test asks the mediator to identify irreversible harms. The author should map that question directly onto Movement 1, which mandates protecting the life ground.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, show the reader how answering question 4 is the functional trigger that unlocks Movement 1. By weaving these two lists together, you eliminate the redundancy and create a single, cohesive, highly dense framework.
A unified map is crucial, especially when we consider the terrain this framework is actually trying to cross. Which brings us to the most difficult destination in the paper.
The sacred memory section.
Yeah, the transformation of sacred memory. Because the directive to transform sacred memory into custodial responsibility is philosophically striking, but the manuscript totally lacks a focused mechanism for how this deeply entrenched cultural shift can actually be practically achieved.
Movement 4 is easily the most fascinating and most challenging part of the entire manuscript. I mean, the author writes that no wound denied, no wound enthroned, and calls for transfiguring sacred memory.
It's a beautiful phrase.
It really is. The stated goal is to take historical traumas and turn them into a universalizing discipline against dehumanization. It's a breathtaking ethical stance. However, the text entirely fails to explain the operational how.
The actual mechanics.
Right. How does a deeply wounded society operating within an active field of generational fear and cultural violence achieve this transfiguration? Right now, it just reads as a desired utopian outcome rather than an actionable peace-building step.
I want to push back on the author's premise here a bit, actually, because the phrase, no wound denied, no wound enthroned, is poetic. But I really struggle to see this functioning outside a philosophy seminar.
Well, it's...
I mean, we're dealing with generations of deeply embedded cultural violence. When you have two communities who possess entirely different realities about who caused the wound, how does a governing body actually legislate or mandate the transfiguration of a sacred narrative?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right? If an international body steps in and says, hey, your sacred trauma is no longer a weapon, it's now a shared custodial responsibility... Doesn't that just feel like forced erasure to the victims? You can't just flip a psychological switch on grief.
You're spot on. And the friction you're describing is exactly why this section currently falters. You simply cannot mandate a psychological shift through a white paper.
It just won't work.
No. The friction of human psychology in a conflict zone will shred a purely philosophical framework in seconds. That's why the suggestion for improvement here is to ground Movement 4 in concrete sociological, institutional, and educational mechanisms.
So giving it teeth.
Exactly. The text must define the specific civil commons infrastructure required to facilitate this cultural transformation. It needs to build the actual bridge from profound, weaponized grief over to shared stewardship.
But what does that bridge actually look like? Because history commissions and, you know, peace dialogues, they often just become new battlegrounds where both sides simply restate their grievances in a more formal setting.
They do, unless the institutional mechanics force a different outcome. Let's map out a few concrete ways the author could ground this. One route is proposing joint historical commissions modeled heavily on successful truth and reconciliation processes. But crucially, with a hard, binding mandate to write shared educational curriculums.
Oh, so tying it to the schools.
Yes. You don't just share the history to air grievances. You share it to determine what the next generation is legally required to be taught in their civic classes. It forces the philosophical concept directly into the classroom.
But again, what forces them to agree on that curriculum? If the wounds are still fresh, the structural coupling the author talks about is currently a coupling of mutual destruction.
Well, that's where you have to introduce legal, physical friction. Let's look at a second path the author could detail, the establishment of interfaith custodial councils that hold actual legal veto power over the management of sacred sites.
Veto power?
Yes. If the goal in Movement 4 is to stop sacred memory from being an engine of domination, you have to force cooperative stewardship.
Meaning neither side can alter, manage, or even access a highly contested site without the institutional consent of the other?
Exactly. The physical reality of the veto power forces the relational shift. When custodial responsibility becomes a strict legal requirement rather than just a moral request, the communities have to practice viable communication just to maintain the site.
Because they literally have no other choice.
Right. the structural coupling is forced to shift from destructive to cooperative because the legal infrastructure demands it.
That shifts the entire burden of the paper, honestly. It takes the biology of love or relational trust building out of the realm of internal emotion and makes it a structural necessity. But wait, what about the unmetabolized trauma itself? The people living near these sites aren't just political actors, they're often deeply traumatized civilians.
Which leads to a third infrastructural approach the author could really explore. The manuscript could detail a specific participatory mourning space initiative.
What does that mean?
This would mean integrating trauma-informed care directly into local civic centers. But the structural key here is linking that psychological repair directly to community funding.
Oh, wow. Tying money to therapy?
In a way, yes. Imagine detailing a mechanism where international reconstruction funds, the literal money needed to rebuild the physical infrastructure of a neighborhood, are directly tied to participation in joint community mourning and trauma healing programs.
So the community's economic viability is inextricably linked to their willingness to process their secret memory without weaponizing it.
Precisely. You create an institutional engine for the very transfiguration the author is asking for.
That makes so much sense.
If the paper details these specific mechanisms, you know, curriculum mandates, legal vetoes, tied funding, Movement 4 stops being a beautifully written wish and becomes a robust, actionable blueprint for civilizational repair.
Because the policymaker reading this doesn't just nod at the poetry anymore.
No, they see the exact levers they need to pull to make it a reality.
That provides the missing gravity to the entire framework. Let's pull back a bit and summarize the core trajectory of our critique today.
Sounds good.
So the underlying ethical vision of this paper is stunning. But to maximize its impact on the actual crisis it aims to solve, the delivery mechanism has to be flawless. First, the author needs to ensure the language meets the policymakers where they are, rather than asking those policymakers to learn a whole new academic vocabulary.
Right, exactly.
Second, the overlapping 7-step frameworks must be integrated into one unified, cohesive protocol to reduce the reader's cognitive load. And finally, the text must provide concrete institutional mechanisms for the transformation of sacred memory so it functions as a practical sociological step rather than just a utopian ideal.
The path forward for this manuscript is incredibly clear. Move the deep academic theory to the appendices and let the accessible policy concepts lead. Merge the arbitration test directly into the peace protocol as its operational engine.
And give us those concrete tools.
Yes, define the specific civil society tools like joint historical commissions or interfaith veto councils needed to execute the transfiguration of memory in Movement 4.
Absolutely. So for the author listening, your ethical vision is remarkable, and the intellectual foundation you've built is incredibly sound. To do it justice, pull the theory back, give the practitioners one unified map, and build concrete bridges for that shared memory.
Definitely.
We highly encourage you to implement these structural and linguistic shifts, and please submit the revised material back in for another critique. We would really love to see how this evolves.